I'm Adam Coleman, inviting you to the fifth season of The Cosmic Library from LitHub. This season, we go on our tiniest reading adventure yet, into short stories in the U.S. But this too turns out to be almost all-encompassing.
I think short stories are essentially brief encounters with felt life.
That's Oxford literary scholar Andrew Kahn, who gives us a deep history of the short story. And we hear from The New Yorker's Deborah Treisman, who explains her work as an editor of short fiction.
You know, if you are melding with another person, you don't turn that person into you, but you get to know the ins and outs of that person. So, and it's sort of like that. I always feel involved with the stories.
We bounce around between the history and current life of short stories with the novelist Justin Taylor.
The nice thing about it going out of fashion is that it really frees you up to relate to it in a different way.
This being the Cosmic Library, we make sure to go way beyond U.S. short stories, too. Here's the Washington Post critic, Becca Rothfeld.
A lot of Kafka short stories, I think, gesture at or describe sort of nightmarish geographies or architectures.
And the actor Max Gordon Moore reminds us just how wild short stories can be. With a reading in its entirety of Wakefield, the intensely strange, classic Nathaniel Hawthorne story.
He had contrived, or rather he had happened to dissever himself from the world, to vanish.
Get ready for all that and more in a season about short stories, small windows into vast universes. It's season 5 of The Cosmic Library, available soon wherever you go for podcasts.
Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and I hope I don't overwhelm today's guest because I underlined so many sections of her book that we're clearly not going to get to it all. But anyway, Elaine Castillo, named one of 30 of the planet's most exciting young people by the Financial Times, was born and raised in the Bay Area. Her debut novel, America Is Not the Heart, was a finalist for numerous prizes, including the L. Big Book Award, the Center for Fiction Prize, and the Aspen Words Literary Prize. Her new collection is called How to Read Now, and I truly barely know where to start. So hi, Elaine.
Hi, that's a really very, very kind introduction. Thank you. It's a real joy to be here.
I do think we should start with your definition for what reading is in the context of your book, because you do discuss so many books and you go so deep and do close line readings, but that is not the only thing you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really came out of my formation as a reader, which was ultimately mixed. I think, you know, like I talk about in the book how my father was a huge reader, but he also came, I mean, my parents, as I say in the book, my parents had a mixed class marriage. You know, my dad came from a kind of upper middle class family in the Philippines and in Ilocos. And, you know, he was very comfortable with literature, with reading. He was a big reader. He passed that down to me. My mom, on the other hand, grew up in rural poverty, and her hold on not just English, but, you know, even Tagalog, because Tagalog is not, though it's the lingua franca of the Philippines, it's not her primary language. So, you know, even, you know, reading things in Tagalog, it would be daunting for my mom sometimes. So, you know, I think I grew up really understanding that while I loved being a reader, that gift was also one that was class inflected. So, and I think because of that, you know, I also had, I mean, movies, TV shows. I mean, I definitely grew up, I think anyone who grew up in the 90s, there's such a huge 90s revival on absolutely every level, fashion, TV,
yes, yes.
Movies. And I'm absolutely part of that, have zero resistance to it. So, I mean, I grew up in the kind of golden era of 90s television, also especially 90s black television and 90s anime, black American television. So, you know, I think I grew up voracious in a lot of ways, because my father was such a huge reader, but he wasn't, you know, he was, well, in the life that I knew him, he was a security guard. In his previous life, he was a surgeon. You know, he didn't have any sort of schooling, that, you know, he didn't have an English degree, he hadn't done any kind of academic, he had no sort of academic relationship to reading. It was really this kind of idiosyncratic, highly personal relationship to reading. And because of that, that's what I got also. So it was just sort of well, read a bunch of stuff. There's no real boundaries between them. You could read sort of Plato and then Babysitter's Club in the same week, and there was nothing wrong with that. In junior high, yeah, I got into trouble. I remember in junior high because I think I turned in some. They were like, "Oh, do your book report," and I think I did it on a. Well, now this is going to sound like a real humble brag.
No, you have to do it now.
Now I have to just lean into it and do a full brag. I think it was Plato's Symposium, and I got it back, and it was like an F, and it was like, "Well, you clearly didn't read this." I was like, "Oh, okay, that's how it goes." So then sometimes, oh, but then that's so funny. I literally just had a flashback to it. At that point, I started making up books that I thought my teachers would believe that I read. I literally just remember, I have not thought about this for 20 years. This is breaking news, or not more than 20 years, 30 years. I used to start making up like YA or like children's novels, like Babysitter's Clubs type stuff. I remember there was like a detective-y murder mystery kind of kids book that I made up and was like, yeah, I read this. And they were like, hey, amazing. They were like, great description of this youth appropriate book. Maybe that should have probably been the first hint that I was a writer. I have not thought about that literally 30 years. That's amazing.
And so when we take in all of this culture, everything that we're taking in is political in some way.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's political whether or not you consider it so, and I would say even more so if you don't consider it so. I argue that freedom is not the right word, the privilege, but also the curse to not have to, you know, think about politics or live in a politicized body, or, you know, to not think that only watching, you know, Beverly Hills 90210 and thinking that's California is political. I mean, I watched those shows and thought they were science fiction. I was like, I don't know. I have never seen this California. I don't know what y'all are talking about. So yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I was lucky enough that books were introduced to me in a way that was so generous, and that wasn't gatekeeping, and that wasn't, you know, there, I mean, what gates would we have kept? So there was such a freewheeling practice of it. And so when I encountered reading practices that weren't like that, that were gatekeeping, you know, it was a real shock to the system.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Yeah, and you talk in the first section about, of course, the publishing industry has traditionally been mostly white. The white reader is the person who is on a publishing person's mind for the most part when they're envisioning an audience. I have to say, I was at the HarperCollins strike yesterday.
Oh, right. I was just reading about this. Yeah.
The assistants are demanding living wages after them. And
how shocking.
I know. And a whole variety of other things. And I went to look at what the number one best-selling book is in America, in the nonfiction category in the Times. And it's a book that basically says we should all continue to teach our children Greek or Latin instead of teaching them to question or analyze their history. And I was like, oh, Elaine, you might have something to say about that.
Well, I mean, first of all, obviously, power and solidarity to all of the strikers at HarperCollins. This is relevant to my interests, not just as a newbie nonfiction writer, but also, you know, I talk about it a little bit in the book, as someone who was a would-be classicist or wanted to be a classicist for a really long time and who grew up on Greek myth. I definitely at some point was like, I'm going to be the Panayan Carson. This is happening. Eros, the bittersweet autobiography of Red, is done. Wrap it up. Let's go. And so I think, you know, I have no issue with teaching Greek or Latin as someone who literally started college learning Greek and Latin and who grew up on Greek mythology. But I think, you know, that is only one part of the argument. It's saying we're teaching Greek and Latin with the understanding that this is the correct way to teach Western civilization to the people who are going to grow up in Western civilization. Or we're teaching this specific narrow set of canon in this specific way in order to produce these very specific type of citizens. You know, I think about it a lot when you think about how, you know, in the kind of 18th century, I mean, the kind of peak colonial sort of Enlightenment era, the approach to, for example, translating classics like the Odyssey, which, you know, I talk about a little bit in the last essay about, you know, thinking about what the colonial era translations of the Odyssey say about that translator's, you know, vision of the world. You know, there's this huge also agenda, and it is a political agenda to portray the Greeks, to portray the Western classics as being this precursor, so that precursor to Western civilization and to a specific idea of Western civilization as Aryan, as white, as civilized, as rational. I mean, that's why, you know, the kind of German archaeologists and classicists at the time, people like Heinrich Schliemann, who, you know, basically, I mean, all the people who stole everything and put it in the British Museum, basically. You know, they were really obsessed with the idea that all of these statues were white. And then, and that really allowed them to perpetuate these ideas about purity, about whiteness, about rationality, about a specific type of beauty, completely leaving out the fact that obviously all of those statues are white because of age at the time. I mean, it's, you know, carbon dating has shown that all of those statues were painted a riot of colors, that those, you know, that the way Greek temples or the way that these sites of worship and of religion and of culture looked like were very different from the image that was then sold to a specific Enlightenment audience and the audiences thereafter. So I think that's you know, something to think about when you think about, well, why are people pushing a specific set of authors? Is it because they just think those authors are, because I love Homer, I love Herodotus, I love reading Horace, you know, Horace, I mean, I talk about Horace, one of his, the Latin poet Horace, who has one of my favorite poems of all time. I love reading him. But how are we reading him, and for what purpose, and to serve what agenda?
Yeah. And it does seem like this particular book, it calls out the books that school children may or may not be studying these days. And it goes very much along with the books that conservatives are trying to ban from school libraries. You talk a lot in the book about free speech arguments to justify appropriation. And then when free speech is actually threatened, we're being told to we should ignore it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, free speech, I mean, like white fragility, like, you know, all of these are things that are so easily weaponized. It's very easy for someone who has tenure to weaponize free speech to protect them from being criticized by a freelance journalist of color for their racism or their transphobia, or, you know, it's very, we have our hold on free speech is selective, to say the least. I mean, also, you know, I think part of that essay that talks a little bit about free speech and the way that it's employed and instrumentalized essentially to protect people from critique. I mean, just something as very simple, to protect something as engagement, which, I mean, as far as I can see it is that's what's supposed to happen in a democratic forum where free speech supposedly exists. The way that that's in, you know, it's really just employed as a kind of aegis. It's employed as a kind of a protective shield. But that's why I'm not that interested in what a soundbite. I'm not that interested in freedom. At least I'm not that interested in the kind of, I mean, that essay talks about this, that kind of essentialist, the idea of American freedom as it exists as an inheritor to the kind of manifest destiny, sort of settler colonial vision of freedom, individualism, ruggedness, you know, the freedom to do what one wants, you know, John Wayne style, to, you know, dip into the Joan Didion essay.
Yes.
And I think I'm much more interested in interconnection, in inheritedness, in indebtedness, in the places that we're not free, where we are delimited, where we are beholden to each other, where those difficult places, or those difficult interstices, that seems to me much more a reflection of, you know, what it is to actually live than, you know, putting forth this idea that artistic freedom is the end all and be all. I'm really much more interested in artistic vulnerability, reliance, interconnection, and indebtedness.
And I do think there's you talk about how there's an incurious market for specific kinds of books. And what a nice way to imagine what you're arguing for, to just like to think, oh, just be more curious about the people around you.
There's nothing in me that wants, I mean, as as strident or as take no prisoners, I think someone recently said that, as the book can be, there's nothing in me that ever wants to talk down to a readership or to believe that, you know, we're not capable of better. When it's because I still believe in reading for my sins. I mean, it's Jesus. Apparently I still do, you know, grudging, optimistic Virgo, I guess.
I love
believes
that.
Believes in things and hates it. I do still believe in what we're capable of as readers.
And you talk about the idea of the unexpected reader. Tell me a little bit about realizing, I guess, that you might be the unexpected reader.
Yeah, I think I just started thinking about it a little bit just because it just became so, you know, going back to this thing that we were saying about, you know, writers or intellectuals or scholars, thinkers being up in arms at the idea of, a white feminist writer being up in arms about a, you know, feminist of color making some critique of her work, or trans readers, you know, talking about J.K. Rowling's transphobia. You know, the kind of shock of not being read as a sycophant, I suppose, the kind of shock, the idea of, you know, that writers, or that, you know, that anyone would be shocked that someone doesn't read them the way they expect themselves to be read, and the way they indeed have always, you know, been allowed to exist in the books they read as readers. And I was just thinking about that because who was it that was talking to me? We were talking about, I think it was one of these very sort of tiresome conversations about sort of separating the art and the artist. Mm-hmm. And I think they were just saying something like, yeah, but like, if we do that, then sort of every book might, you know, it'll be difficult to, how are you going to read books? Because it'll be difficult to, it just complicates them, and you'll have to feel uncomfortable with every book that you read. Is that something that you're experiencing for the first time at the big age of, you know, what, 35? I just, I'm confused. Just because, you know, if I, as a kid, if I'm reading Plato's Symposium or George Eliot or, you know, any of the readers that I've read and loved, or Greek myth, frankly, you know, I was an interloper in all of those worlds. There was no, you know, there was no expectation that any of those books were ever going to hold my hand through the references that they made, through the world that they made. Certainly not, you know, if I, there was, I mean, that feeling was never more so apparent when I would read books or watch television shows where then someone would mention like a either would be a Filipino character, but you know, like could say as Diary of a Bad Year that I mentioned in the essay, or I remember there was a there was a Absolutely Fabulous episode. I remember that. You know that British comedy show, Abfab? Yeah, there was an episode. I remember I really liked that show. They used to show it on PBS. And I remember I showed it. I was going to show an episode to a friend of mine. And that the episode that I showed happened to be the episode where I think one of them, let's say Edwina, one of them just starts, it just makes a like real sort of passing ridiculing comment about like Filipino houseboys. And my friend was Filipino and she was like, oh, this is the show you're introducing me to. And I remember we were like 12 or 13 and she like gave middle fingers up to the show. She was like, fuck you. I was like, oh wow, we're 13 and I fucked up. I didn't know.
You know, and then the flip side of that, which you talk about in the book, is that when you wrote your first novel, you didn't always offer translations.
No, and I don't see why I would or should, or translations or glossaries. Not that I have problems necessarily with translations or glossaries. I just have problems with translations and glossaries when they're assumed to be the purview only of writers of color, or of immigrant writers, or writers who are writing about non-English spaces, countries, cultures, because that's the assumption, that there are certain writers that are obligated to provide safari trips and that other writers and artists aren't. You know, I was just thinking about this recently because this is the very first time that I'm part of a zeitgeist. I am also watching The Bear with everyone else. Normally I'm late to everything. Literally, I just started watching The Americans, which, you know, people in my life are fucking horrified. I'm like, this show is amazing. They're like, Elaine, please join a society. And just watched Succession recently also, but I was watching The Bear and I really enjoyed it. And one of the things that I really loved about it is that it throws people into a world with no translation. It's like loads of chef dialogue. I mean, loads of chef jargon, loads of, you know, Chicago stuff. I don't know anything about it. And yet you're thrown in. Some things are translated in context, some things aren't. And you just gotta run with it. I mean, you just have to, you know, sink or swim, and hopefully swim. And I think the you know, incredible, sorry, this suddenly started transcribing my words. I love that about the show. I love the pace of it, the unapologetic, the fact that it does not translate its world to anyone. But then at the same time, I think, well, I haven't seen any reviews talk about, oh, I wish this show had translation and glossaries because it was, you know, really difficult to understand. It was more, oh, it's so fast paced. Everyone is very into the main character and, you know, all of that. So I think that's something that is curious to me. That's like, okay, well, this is a show that's very much speaking its own language, that very much starts off, this is the specific dialect of this show, you know, join in or not. And yet I think that if there was a it's funny because I was watching it and I was like, oh well, I think I've been very resistant to, well, not resistant, but I was like, well, if my first novel was ever adapted, that's the spirit that I would, the spirit of that show. I was like, oh, this is the first time I've ever seen a show where I thought like, yeah, like that, just because of that resistance to translation, resistance to translating itself. So that's, you know, it's something that I think about when I think about, well, who doesn't have to provide glossaries and translations? Because I don't know. I mean, I love Victor Hugo because I freaking go on like 3-page long digressions about him in the work cited. But, you know, if you don't know anything about English aristocracy or French aristocracy or anything for that matter, it's like, you know, he's not providing glossaries for you. I think it's much more fun. Like, I actually think we should reclaim glossaries. I think it would be great to do glossaries, but for like cultural stuff, not for like language stuff, but like if people could just explain, I don't know, like astrology.
That's a whole stuff book like in itself.
Stuff like that.
I love that. And I also find that like, if I'm reading a book about a culture I'm not familiar with, the cool thing about reading these days is usually my phone is right with me too. And
you're not reading a word yourself.
You're curious about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's also just no shame in pockets of uncertainty and unknowledge, knowledge that, you know, things that are maybe felt or seen or heard but aren't understood. I mean, that's, you know, I think a lot of us, it's easy to forget that a lot of reading happens like that. A lot of reading happens. It doesn't, you know, reading is not sort of, you know, plug it in and download it and then I've got everything and then, you know, 100% mm-hmm. downloaded. You know, it's a much more piecemeal personal experience. I mean, I can read one book and I know that a friend who's read the same book won't have read the same book as me. We'll just pick up on different things, you know, we'll miss different things. So that's also just part of reading as well.
Yeah. I love that. So in the same chapter that opens Another Day, Another Shit Show involving J.K. Rowling.
It's a really staid book, you know, it's a really...
So you do this wonderful deep dive into The Watchmen, which we are clearly not going to get around to, but what I did want to talk about, again, especially today, especially the past few years, is The Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, yeah.
And the way that that book has become a stand-in for so many problems that existed for so long outside the scope of Canadians.
I haven't watched the show, actually. I mean, we're going back to me being behind on many things. Listen, I just started The Americans, so you can't expect I'm not a contemporary soul. But yeah, you know, I was thinking a little bit. I mean, I think The Handmaid's Tale is one of the books that I mentioned just when I think about just a certain, you know, sci-fi fantasy books that describe a kind of utopia, or not utopia. Well, a utopia for some, actually, that's not true. Yeah, I think a utopia for some, a utopia for a very specific political class, and a dystopia for everyone else. You know, like Margaret Atwood, or like X-Men, or like, you know, some of the sci-fi fantasy.
Hunger Games
that, you know, that describe dystopia, but within the confines of the universe, the actual people are usually left kind of raceless, placeless, you know, it sort of uproots or puts them in a kind of no place, despite, you know, the authors usually copying in interviews and post interviews about those works that they were inspired by. You know, Margaret Atwood talks about being inspired by the, you know, disappearance under the Argentinian junta and the regime of Ferdinand Marcos, also very relevant considering the recent Philippines election. yeah, so I think, you know, what I'm thinking about is how the sci-fi fantasy imagination is based entirely on essentially taking the histories and the realities lived largely by marginalized communities and largely communities of color and transposing them onto raceless, which is to say, in a cultural industry that assumes that neutral is white, transposes them into white bodies, white actors, white characters, and divests those histories of, you know, they're very specific contexts in a way that then ultimately produces the impression that, well, it's people who, I guess, look like, who's the main actress in The Handmaid's Tale? I haven't watched it, but you know, that it's white characters, white bodies, white communities that are under siege. I mean, that's also part of the vagaries of Hollywood casting and Hollywood and publishing industry as well. The idea that, well, stories about dystopia or stories about marginalization are only palatable if the bodies are sympathetic, and the only bodies that we find sympathetic really happen to be white bodies. So there's that, you know, I think I want to think more about that just because, you know, I really grew up on sci-fi fantasy. I really loved I loved X-Men. I loved, I watched The Hunger Games, you know, I sent those books to my brother at a difficult time in his life. And you know, so I don't write about sci-fi fantasy as an outsider. I write about them as someone who is very deeply invested and who came up on those stories, who came up on X-Men, and who, you know, I came up on Rogue. So then when you Rogue from X-Men, so then when you read that the original artist or writer wanted Rogue to look like Grace Jones, but the artist didn't know what Grace Jones looked like, that that hits different to
sure hits to, different
to, you know, so I think there's that. I mean, I think understanding how our contemporary sort of white authored sci-fi fantasy functions in a society helps us to understand then why there's such a reactionary wave within sci-fi fantasy fandom, why there's such militant resistance to, you know, quote unquote social justice warriors clamoring for something as basic as, you know, superheroes of color or pay equity or more, you know, authors of color and more characters of color in sci-fi fantasy worlds. Not, and I don't find that any, I mean, you know, I think the last essay, or no, the second to last essay makes very clear that I have a lot of suspicions and misgivings around representation matters art, quote unquote, and the paucity of representation matters art, and the paucity of just thinking, well, we'll throw some Black and Asian characters into
I'm gonna
Star
quote
Wars
you
universe.
To yourself.
Okay.
Because this is a line that really stuck out for me. No one wants your Sheen Hall of diverse characters capitalized.
Oh, God.
I know this is chef's kiss.
You know, I really thought that I should just go gently and really beat around the bush about how I think about characters and representation. Oh yeah, yes, I did say no one wants your Sheehan Hall of diverse characters, but frankly, no one wants your Sheehan Hall of diverse characters, fam. Like, but you know, that's thinking that that's enough. I think that's I've probably started spiraling, but that's more or less what sort of inspired me thinking about, yeah, books like The Handmaid's Tale. And
I would like to talk a little bit more about Joan Didion. You devote a lot of time for her, and she's someone I like, and I fully get that criticism, especially about her being the voice on California, because her family has been there for generations.
No, that's I think the crux of most of what I want to talk about there. It's not really, you know, I there's a lot of Joan Didion. Wow, okay. That's, Joan Didion's writing that I also appreciate. I mean, it's very similar to Austen. You know, when I critiqued the reception, you know, in the one of the early essays when I talk about Austen, I really love Austen. And if we start talking about the Persuasion adaptation, we will be here for 3 hours. So let me just move past that. You know, I really love and have a lot of affection for Austen, especially Persuasion. But what I'm interested in critiquing is how the kind of cultural industry around her that's resistant to thinking about Austen's historical context, or abolition around her time, or what other writers were thinking about, or that, you know, that it's somehow anachronistic to talk about race in connection to Austen, or the slave trade in connection to Austen, or, you know, that somehow diminishes her legacy. And I think there's a similar impulse with thinking about Joan Didion. It's not really Joan Didion's writing per se, although I'm not, come as a surprise to say I'm not a huge fan, but it's not her writing per se, but it for me, it is the fact that she is understood really trumpeted as this kind of the preeminent voice of California. And I for me, it's important to think about, well, why that is. You know, what is the investment in making her voice the voice of California? What is that voice actually saying? And so what is it producing culturally when we say a voice like this is the voice of California? What images of California, what beliefs about California are we upholding by saying, well, okay, someone who is a fifth generation Californian being landed gentry, as, you know, one of the quotes about Didion talks about, what does that actually mean within a settler colonial history of California? You know, what are the visions of California that are being upheld and what are the visions of California that are being erased and obscured.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And then you, of course, talk about Tommy Pico's nature poem. And I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about that, please? Because I think it's a good, let's talk about something that you really love.
Well, I think knowing that my constitution is one that some might call combative, grim hag adjacent. I think it's also really important for me, you know, so much of this book is also really fundamentally based in love.
Yeah.
In the books that I love and the art that I love and the writing and the art, that's the films, the TV shows that have sparked real love in me, that have, you know, given me life, to put it very simply. So I think, you know, I think that's why I wanted to talk about Tommy Pico in that essay. It's not just because, well, I think because, you know, if I'm going to essentially critique a California icon, I'm not really interested in the business of just, you know, hack job for a hack job or tearing someone down. I'm interested in giving it when I can, and I can't always, you know. I don't think I think sometimes writers have, I was going to say, interested in giving alternatives, or interested in although I think writers of color are also often asked to give alternatives.
This is for alternatives
for the reading. Yeah, exactly. But I think for me, it's really just because there is California writing that I love, that I feel alive to, that I think does, you know, that doesn't willfully obscure whole swathes or swaths of California history and California life, and that is honest and funny and sharp. And, you know, I think the first time I read a Tommy Pico poem, it might have been Nature Poem. I can't remember if it was a Nature Poem or if it was IRL. I think I was on the plane, and you know, if you read or watch movies on the plane, I think it's the cabin pressure. But if you read or watch movies on the plane, you're sobbing. That's just what's happening. So that's where I was at. But you know, it is also some of my favorite California writing. I think he's magnificent. How he writes about California and that combination of like bathos, but also writing. You know, he's fundamentally as a contemporary native Californian poet writing about nature. I mean, to write a nature poem, given the history of how, you know, nature is understood, manipulated, weaponized in a settler colonial context, it's so galvanizing, I think. It's so, and so personal. So the idea, and it's not a reclamation, I think, which is what I think is really what's the most sort of enriching, is that it doesn't step into the kind of easy political mode of, well, not easy political mode, but the kind of easier modes of being, well, I'm reappropriating this genre for myself. Like, you know, I'm going to reappropriate the Western and, you know, John Wayne's Filipino this time. Okay, well, does that do anything about the power dynamics that are inherent in the Western or settler colonial, or you just want to be the one holding the gun this time? You know, so that he has that wonderful line that reclamation requires social capital, and I just love that. I think it's, you know, how do we think about these histories in ways that don't then ultimately end by wanting to put ourselves at the top of the pyramid? So that's, you know, and it's also just it's so fucking good
and funny.
It's so fucking good. It's just so funny.
And your book is very funny, so
thank you.
Humor.
Shout out to Shein for that sponsorship. I'm just kidding.
I can keep going, but I'm gonna.
I'm happy to keep going. It's fun, but you know,
yeah. Stay around a half hour. But this was so great. Yeah, and I have to walk the dog. Before we go though, please recommend some books for us.
Oh, well, I mean, this book really is a kind of glorified reading list in a way. So I mean, all of the books that are in it, Jamaica Kincaid's Lucy, Tommy Pico's everything, Tommy Pico's Nature Poem, IRL, John Berger, John Berger's To the Wedding, and Lilac and Flag, I really love. I love his fiction. I've been reading, I think like most writers, especially if you're working on a novel, what you're reading is always very weird. You're just never reading the same thing as other people. But I have read A Common Normal Heart by Chelsea T. Hicks, a native Californian writer. I think she's touring right now. I blurb that book and it's great. I mean, I'm always really impressed by people who are short form writers because it's a collection of short stories, just because my brain doesn't function in the short form at all. So I mean, it's a great collection of contemporary native short stories about like the Osage diaspora, and it's fantastic. And I've been reading Shark Dialogues by Kiana Davenport. She's a Hawaiian writer. So a weird bunch of things, but there's lots more books in the actual book.
I love it. And you have a really great, what do you call it? Sorry. It's a work cited, but it goes pretty deep. And I love how you call it kind of a literary land acknowledgement.
I hope so. I hope it can function as that. Yeah, the work cited, I really went ham. I was like, yeah, it's a work cited. Y'all can't edit me. So I'm going to talk about literally every single book on the planet.
Perfect.
I think at some point people were like, do you need this digression on Victor Hugo and Spencer and Sally Hawkins in Persuasion? I was like, yeah, absolutely. I do.
For sure. Elaine, thank you so much. The book is How to Read Now.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was absolutely a joy.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.